For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we're exploring the non-fiction shelves in the library. Ben McIntyre introduces us to some colourful spies.
I mean, one of the extraordinary things about intelligence files is that they are honest in a way that most government files are not.
Robert Kirkwood discovers more about the doyen of biographers, James Boswell.
Dictionary definition of the word oats, a grain which in England is fed to horses, but which in Scotland supports the people.
And Sean Biffle reveals the trials and tribulations of running a bookshop.
And with one very simple operation, we can convert this broken, ordinary Kindle into a Kindle Fire.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. When it comes to the history of military intelligence, Ben McIntyre is the man. Over the past 25 years, he's published definitive accounts of counter-espionage during World War II, a biography of Kim Philby, a guide to Ian Fleming, and most recently, Rogue Heroes, the authorised wartime history of the SAS. With access to top secret files and the journalist's nose for a story, he has cast new light on the shadowy existence of the secret agent. Working behind enemy lines, those often flamboyant characters inhabit a world recognisable to fans of Ian Fleming and John le Carré alike. However, the stories recounted by Ben McIntyre actually happened, and the stakes really were life or death. Ben McIntyre, welcome to Read On Air. So, what led you into the world of military intelligence?
Well, if I'm absolutely honest, I've always been fascinated by spying. And on leaving Cambridge, I was, in fact, briefly tapped up, as they say, to go and have a conversation with a man who gave me a false name in a location in London. Needless to say, they worked out pretty quickly that I was definitely not the stuff of spying, since I obviously couldn't keep a secret. I practically told everybody the moment I got out. But I've always thought that spying, both military and sort of civilian spying, if to put it that way, offers a backdrop that mostly novelists commandeer. It's the world of loyalty, love, betrayal, adventure, romance. Now that's normally the preserve of novelists, but if you can get access to sufficiently detailed material and proper documentary material, that's the stuff of spying. So it really addresses a world that in non-fiction is pretty unique, I think.
And how have you managed to gain access to that material? Presumably you've had to build quite a lot of trust within the corridors of secrecy.
Well, it's true. I mean, by now, I think I'm now on my sixth spy book, so I do know quite a lot of the people involved in all of that. But the truth is, I don't really get privileged access to documentary material. A lot of what I write about is in the National Archives. Starting under Blair, there was a real sea change in attitudes towards official secrecy in this country. The government decided progressively to start releasing MI5 files. Now, a crucial distinction, of course, is between MI5 and MI6. Both are military titles, Military Intelligence 5 and Military Intelligence 6. Of course, they've long ceased to be specifically military operations. But MI5 is the security service, which deals with threats to Britain's security. So they mostly work in Britain, although not exclusively. And then MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, is devoted to foreign intelligence. But again, not exclusively. They're also, you know, dealing with foreign sources in Britain. So there's a certain amount of overlap. MI6 will never release its files. They have a different philosophy, really, in approach. And it's completely understandable, really. They say, and I get this, that if they reveal the identity of agents, it becomes very, very difficult to recruit other agents. MI5 takes a very different view, which is that after 50 years, MI5 can begin, if it wishes to, and there is a sort of grey area here, I use the term wishes to carefully, they can start releasing their files. And starting in 2002, that is exactly what they started doing. They started going back, particularly over the wartime files, and identifying specific cases that could, they believed, without threat to national security or embarrassing anyone's privacy, start to be released. And I was extraordinarily lucky. I mean, the first book that I wrote in this area was a book about a double agent called Eddie Chapman, who had been a sort of career criminal before the war, a tremendously engaging and extremely bad man, who found absolutely intriguing, but who ended up as an MI5 agent. He was in prison in Jersey at the time of the Nazi invasion of the Channel Islands, and had volunteered his services to the Germans. He maintained as a way of escaping from prison, which I think was one of the reasons for doing it. He was also an amazing opportunist who couldn't resist that kind of offer. He was trained in a special spy school in France and then parachuted back into Britain on a kind of sabotage intelligence mission. This will give you an idea of what Chapman was like. The moment he landed, he immediately handed himself over to MI5 and offered to spy for them against the Germans. So he's an interesting case because, of course, he was picked up by MI5 because he was a threat to British security. And so, therefore, his files fall under that area. His files became accessible under the 50-year rule. But interestingly, of course, Chapman was then redeployed back into occupied Europe. So in a way, he seems to be an MI6 agent, although he's being run by MI5. So that was an opportunity to write about foreign intelligence and this particular bizarre case with access to the full files. And the Zigzag files, he was codenamed Zigzag, which was a sort of internal MI5 joke because they were never quite sure whose side he was on. The joke going that, you know, a man who could zig could also zag, and therefore there was a strong possibility that he might well have flipped back to the Germans. They were never absolutely sure whether to trust Eddie Chapman. And the Zigzag files were just the most incredible resource. I mean, they are, and I'm not exaggerating, they stand about 3 feet high. They contain letters, diaries, memos, photographs, poems written by Chapman in prison, all sorts of really detailed, that wonderful warp and weft that you can get from these files. Because, I mean, one of the extraordinary things about intelligence files is that they are honest in a way that most government files are not. Most official documentation is written by people who expect it to be read by the bosses. And so, therefore, it's almost always trying to frame a particular line. It's always either sort of doing in their rivals or making themselves feel good or look good to someone else. The intelligence files were never intended or expected to be read by anybody outside a very small circle of people. And so, therefore, they're absolutely honest about what's going on. And so when it goes wrong, as it frequently does in intelligence, instead of trying to cover it up or sort of blame someone else, they're completely open about the disasters. So you get this hilarious kind of marginalia in some of the files saying, you know, oh, my God, we are completely up the creek with this one. And so I love that. I love the fact that you really felt you could get inside, to some extent, you could get inside the minds and the personalities, not just of the agents and the spies, but also of the case officers and the people running this bizarre organisation.
Well, there's certainly a collection of great eccentrics and mavericks and great characters who one would be suspicious of if they turned up in a work of fiction, but actually, as you say, that their true characters come out of your books because of that honesty.
Well, I think it is partly the honesty. I think it's also that this world, this odd world of espionage, and I've never been quite sure whether it creates people who are slightly mad or whether it simply attracts people who are already slightly mad. And that goes for both the sort of the spies themselves and the people who are running them. It is a most eccentric and picaresque world. On the other hand, I mean, as Churchill himself observed, in order to want to be part of this strange process of spying on other people, you have to have a particular sort of character. Churchill called it a corkscrew mind. You don't think in straight lines. You think laterally often. You think in very imaginative ways. And that gives these people a real sort of patina to their lives that is quite different, I think, from really any other profession in the world. I mean, we have a funny attitude towards spying in Britain. We both don't trust it and find it slightly sinister, the idea of people keeping secrets. On the other hand, there is no country in the world more obsessed by its spies, starting with James Bond. Actually, not starting with James Bond, preceding James Bond by a considerable period. As a people, Britons are very good at spying. To coin a phrase, nobody does it better. And I think it is some element in the British character, this sort of theatricality. I don't think it's necessarily a love of mendacity exactly, but we love to make believe, we love to play, we love to play with the truth and to act things out. And I think it's no accident in a way that, you know, the greatest, really some of the greatest novelists of the 20th century were all spies. I mean, if you go back, Somerset Maugham, Ian Fleming, Graham Greene, John le Carré, Freddie Forsyth, they were all involved to some extent with the spy world, because spies are not so different from novelists in some ways. They make up a parallel world, a parallel fictional world, and the better they are at luring other people into it, the better they are at it.
And actually that came through very strongly in your follow-up to Agent Zigzag, Operation Mincemeat, about the ruse to wrongfoot the Germans as to where the Allies were going to invade in 1943. I believe there were three novelists working on the plot of Operation Mincemeat.
That's exactly right. I mean, Mincemeat was the most bizarre case, really. I mean, it was an attempt to fool the Germans into believing that the invasion from North Africa was going to start in Sicily. Not going to start in Sicily, but going to start in Greece and Sardinia. And to this end, they got hold of a dead body, which they had located in a coroner's in St. Pancras. They effectively stole it. And they invested this poor fellow, who was a sort of dead Welsh tramp, invested him with an entirely new personality. They turned him into someone else. They turned him into Major Martin of the Royal Marines, and they equipped him with a uniform and false papers and a briefcase chained to his hand. It sounds like it's a plot for a sort of mad Hollywood movie, which in fact it did subsequently become. And they released this body off the coast of Spain because they knew there was a particular spy operating on the coast of Spain who was tremendously efficient and obviously rather naive as well. And they believed if they could get these documents into his hands, it would pass all the way up the chain of command. And they were right. I mean, the bizarre thing is that having imagined this sort of parallel world, it began to take on reality. And the reason we know this, and the reason that the framers of this bizarre Operation Mincemeat, as they called it, again, a sort of in-joke, they just particularly thought it was rather macabre to have a dead body called Mincemeat. I mean, they were very odd, these people. As this thing, they could follow the lie going down the gullet, as it were, of German intelligence, because Bletchley Park was providing sort of real-time intelligence on what the Germans believed, and it became clear that this enormously elaborate set of lies was being swallowed, mincemeat, as they put it, was being swallowed whole. It rather panicked them, actually, because I think they hadn't realised it was going to work quite so well, and they began to wonder, crikey, I hope we've got this absolutely right, because if the Germans rumble us, they're going to realise it's the reverse of the truth, at which point they will realise the target is Sicily. So although, you know, it is a very amusing case in lots of ways, the stakes could not have been higher. I mean, 150,000 Allied troops were about to attack Sicily. If the Germans didn't believe this ruse, or worse, realised it was a ruse, Sicily was going to be heavily defended and there was going to be a bloodbath.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I first came across that story as The Man Who Never Was, I think an old black and white film that we probably watched on BBC Two when we were teenagers at home. Were you brought up with those sort of Second World War books and films?
Absolutely. I mean, I would spend, like many boys of my age, I would spend my Sunday afternoons watching Dam Busters and, frankly, anything else with a wartime theme. So, no, I grew up on all that stuff. And The Man Who Never Was is actually a sort of cinematic classic in a way. It's based on the book written by one of the key architects of Operation Mincemeat, Ewan Montagu, who actually appears in the film as a sort of sceptical wing commander at the end, saying, "This will never work, you know, Bunty." So he sort of appears in his own film. I mean, I loved those films. I absolutely adored them. But the more I write about this area of history, the more I begin to realise that those black and white films, that sort of those rather propagandist films about how Britain won the war, are fundamentally very misleading. Because they're very black and white. War is not black and white. The more I write about this, the more I am convinced that yes, war is not a matter of black and white. War is painted in shades of grey. And it's about ordinary people having to make appalling decisions in circumstances not of their making. And to me, that's always been absolutely fascinating. And you find good people who find themselves having to do very bad things in war. And you find very bad people, like Eddie Chapman, who find themselves almost inadvertently on the right side of history. And I've always been fascinated by how people arrive at those sorts of decisions. What would you do? I mean, it seems to me that sort of history of the sort that I write, I hope at its best, asks the question, what would you do? How would you have responded in these circumstances? And one of the lovely things about going back to a story like The Man Who Never Was or Operation Mincemeat is being able to take the version that was told to us as children, that was told to us post-war, and really interrogate it, really take another look at it, and look at it through our sensibility, through what I would argue is a much more sophisticated sense of psychology and morality and ethics and opportunity, and be able to pose that question in a much less black and white way, really, to be able to say, actually, life is not like that. Life is a good deal more complicated and hairy.
And actually, you brought exactly that to the story of Kim Philby as well. Your book, A Spy Among Friends, The Great Betrayal, is far less hysterical than the sort of immediate post-defection books, and looks to explain why a man like Philby could betray his best friends and all his operatives.
I found the Philby story utterly fascinating. And again, I took it on with some trepidation, because this is a story that we all thought we knew, because it's absolutely sort of stitched into our cultural DNA, the defection of Kim Philby. But I think hysterical is a very good word to describe the way the defection and his career of espionage was portrayed immediately afterwards. It was simply, you know, he was a bad communist. You know, he was a liar, he was a cheat, he was a dissembler. He was, of course, all of those things. But he was a tremendously interesting man, and I think if we had met him, most of us would have found him utterly charming, completely plausible, terribly interesting, very concerned, highly intelligent. He's not a black and white figure, Philby, and having spent, gosh, nearly 3.5 years with Kim Philby, deeply digging as deeply as I could into him, I still found myself feeling intensely ambivalent about him. On the one hand, he was someone with a steel in his heart, a sort of shard of ice. He was able to send people to their deaths without a single thought, plenty of thought, but absolutely no regret. I mean, and the death toll from Philby's betrayal numbers in the hundreds, if not the thousands. I mean, he betrayed entire operations in Albania, where not just the agents themselves were rounded up, but their families and friends, and all were executed. You know, I mean, the bloodshed was extraordinary. On the other hand, Philby was a most remarkable man. He was a brilliant intelligence officer. He really knew what he was doing, which is why, you know, he was so good at the job. And even at the end, I found myself, despite all the betrayal and so on, feeling that some part of me would still have enjoyed his company greatly.
The fanatical faith in communism came through, and I found myself thinking, had he had that fanatical faith in liberal democracy, then he would have been hailed as a great champion and maybe even been a great politician. But it was because it was something that made him into an enemy of the state that he had to be treated as such a pariah.
I think you put your finger on it. I mean, the truth is, I think had he not been a communist, had he been able to sort of, as it were, shed that early adherence, he would undoubtedly have been head of SIS. I think he would have ended up running MI6. He was destined for the top. He was a highly able, very subtle, supple man. His conversion to communism again was tended to be treated, it seemed to me, in the sort of post-defection world. I mean, when he went off to Russia in 1963 and never came back again. And that was treated as if, you know, this kind of die-hard, never-say-die communist had somehow sort of outwitted the Secret Service and run off. It wasn't quite like that. I mean, I think he was a pure-driven ideologue in the 1930s. There's no doubt that he and the rest of the Cambridge Five, Burgess, Maclean, and so on, they really did. They took the Kool-Aid. I mean, they absolutely believed wholeheartedly in this. Some stuck with it. Donald Maclean, I think, never wavered in his adherence. But Philby was different. I mean, he started out being motivated by pure ideology. I don't think that necessarily lasted through his lifetime, because we all change over time. I mean, there's a tendency, again, to see people as pure examples of political thought. Nobody's like that. Philby was also loved the adventure. He loved the romance. He was an intensely arrogant man, and he had that thing, which I think is a kind of British male, I hesitate to say this, a sort of male upper-class trait, which is that he liked to be a bit cleverer than the person standing next to him in the bus queue. He enjoyed that sensation of, in the book I describe it as the sort of ruthless exercise of private power. That's what he loved, and he got off on it. And after a while, that kind of infidelity becomes a drug. And Philby was, well, you can see it in his emotional life as well. I mean, he was an absolutely addicted philanderer and adulterer, much married, but absolutely never faithful. And that faithlessness itself, I think, became part of his character, part of his charm too, let's not deny it. But he wasn't, you know, to see him simply as an emblem of brutal communism is to reduce him.
Directing his own play, a sort of Prospero figure then, more than a ruthless communist in sort of reverse McCarthy.
I think that's exactly right. I think that is, yes, and that goes in a way for quite a lot of these characters. I mean, to go back to Eddie Chapman for a second, I mean, he too really considered himself to be the main actor in his own drama. He'd actually been a film extra early on in his life, and he lived the sort of life where he sort of imagined a film camera was running behind him the whole time. And so a certain sense of self-inflating drama of being the star of your own show, albeit that nobody else knows that's what you're doing, absolutely animates many of these characters and runs through spying in general.
Thanks again to Ben McIntyre. Many of his books are available in a range of formats from the RNIB library, including Agent Zigzag, which is TB-15429, Operation Mincemeat, which is TB-17582, and A Foreign Field, which is TB-22009, which tells a previously forgotten story that happened during the First World War.
RNIB, supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services, and loads more. Or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, bookshop owner Sean Biffle will kindle fire with an e-book reader. But before that, the Boswell Book Festival is an annual celebration of biography and memoir, named after James Boswell, who's regarded as the father of modern biography. The festival is held in the Ayrshire countryside where he grew up. Keen to find out more about the man and his legacy, Robert Kirkwood spoke to the festival's director, Caroline Knox, editor of the Boswell Editions, Gordon Turnbull, and all the way from the University of Otago in New Zealand, Dr. Paul Tankard. But first, here's a clip from Boswell's epic Life of Samuel Johnson, narrated by Jonathan Oliver, which comes in at a whopping 67 and a half hours.
Boswell's advertisement to the first edition. I at last deliver to the world a work which I have long promised, and of which, I am afraid, too high expectations have been raised. The delay of its publication must be imputed, in a considerable degree, to the extraordinary zeal which has been shown by distinguished persons in all quarters to supply me with additional information concerning its illustrious subject, resembling in this the grateful tribes of ancient nations, of which every individual was eager to throw a stone upon the grave of a departed hero, and thus to share in the pious office of erecting an honourable monument to his memory.
James Boswell sprang from an ancient Ayrshire family which had been settled at Auchinleck since the 16th century. He was born in Edinburgh in 1740, where his father, who became Lord Auchinleck, was a judge in the Supreme Court of Scotland. His mother was descended from a minor branch of Scottish royalty. Now, from the start, Bozzy, as he was affectionately known, was drawn to the pleasure-loving side of life. His first visit to London at the age of 19 began a love affair with the city, which never wavered. But the ultimate prize for Boswell was his friendship with the towering figure of Dr. Samuel Johnson, compiler of the definitive dictionary of the English language and celebrated man of letters. Boswell's friendship led him to become Johnson's biographer, and the account of his life has never been out of print. His Life of Johnson established him as the inventor of modern biography and has upheld his reputation as one of the most innovative writers of the Enlightenment.
In reflecting that the illustrious subject of this work, by being more extensively and intimately known, however elevated before, has risen in the veneration and love of mankind, I feel a satisfaction beyond what fame can afford. We cannot indeed too much or too often admire his wonderful powers of mind, when we consider that the principal store of wit and wisdom which this work contains was not a particular selection from his general conversation, but was merely his occasional talk at such times as I had the good fortune to be in his company. And without doubt, if his discourse at other periods had been collected with the same attention, the whole tenor of what he uttered would have been found equally excellent.
More recently, Boswell's fame redoubled in the 20th century with the discovery and publication of his diaries, setting him alongside Pepys as one of the great diarists in the English language. Boswell ushered in the confessional memoir, which is so popular today. Nothing was omitted, including the innumerable sexual encounters, his battle with depression, his difficult relationship with his father, his frustrated political ambition, and his life as a lawyer in the Scottish courts. We'll find out more about the papers in a moment from George Turnbull and from Paul Tankard. But first, I asked Festival Director Caroline Knox how the Boswell Book Festival started.
It started because we have created a trust to promote the name of James Boswell, the great biographer who comes from Auchinleck in Ayrshire. And we realised quite early on that his work is no longer read. And we thought, how can we bring the attention back onto him? And as he was the founder of modern biography, the idea came that we should start a festival which was dedicated to telling people's life stories. So in other words, a festival of biography and memoir. We are the world's only festival of biography and memoir. And then the other thing we wanted to do was also bring a book festival into Ayrshire, because there's one in Glasgow and one in Wigton, but nothing in this part of the world. And we wanted to actually help the regeneration of this bit of the southwest. We moved from James Boswell's own home, Auchinleck House, because it sounds really mundane, because we'd run out of car parking spaces. We loved it there, and authors who love Boswell loved it there. But as we grew, we just did not have the space, and people were having to park in mud, and, you know, it just became too uncomfortable for people to want to come. So that's when we were very lucky to be welcomed here by Prince Charles and his team. And this has allowed us to expand, because we are using part of the estate as well. So our children's festival is down in the School of Engineering, and we have the Royal Drawing School here this year. So it's allowing us to expand and do different things.
Now, Boswell's book about Samuel Johnson is in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and the audio version comes in at 67 and a half hours.
Wow.
It's a bit of an epic work.
And I think that Boswell found in Johnson the father figure that he didn't have in his own father, with whom he was often in conflict. And of course, Johnson was a great writer, more than just a great writer. And of course, Boswell, that was what Boswell adored, and he loved mixing with people who were writers, artists. And so in a way, the older man became the father figure that perhaps he might have chosen if he, you know, hadn't had his own father, Lord Auchinleck.
My vanity, or my kindness, makes me flatter myself that you would rather hear of me than of those whom I have mentioned. But of myself I have very little which I care to tell. Last winter I went down to my native town, where I found the streets much narrower and shorter than I thought I had left them, inhabited by a new race of people to whom I was very little known. My playfellows were grown old, and forced me to suspect that I was no longer young. My only remaining friend has changed his principles and has become the tool of the predominant faction. My daughter-in-law, from whom I expected most, and whom I met with sincere benevolence, has lost the beauty and gaiety of youth without having gained much of the wisdom of age.
Our theme allows us to program it, I think, in a more interesting way, because we are looking for people who have written... They're either great biographers, or we simply look at people who've written a book and who have an extraordinary life story to tell. I think it allows us a freedom. We don't have to go chasing the newest book all the time. We're chasing the most interesting life stories, and we try to get a real breadth, which is what... Because Boswell, in his own diaries, he's interested in everybody. And so we try to mimic this interest in everybody across our programme. And, I mean, it is indeed a challenge getting writers from London up here, because they have to give up a weekend to come to the festival.
I'm sure they don't mind.
But when they get here, of course, I think they love it, and they love the Ayrshire audience. The amount of writers who've said to me, our audience is particularly attentive and really warm and welcoming, I think they really appreciate that.
And a reply to Mr. Samuel Johnson from Norfolk Street, April the 23rd, 1755. Sir, the part of your dictionary which you have favoured me with the sight of has given me such an idea of the whole that I most sincerely congratulate the public upon the acquisition of a work long wanted and now executed with an industry, accuracy, and judgment equal to the importance of the subject. You might perhaps have chosen one in which your genius would have appeared to more advantage, but you could not have fixed upon any other in which your labours would have done such substantial service to the present age and to posterity.
Another clip there of Jonathan Oliver reading The Life of Johnson by James Boswell. Now, Dr. Gordon Turnbull is head of the Great Boswell Editorial Project at Yale University. I asked him if Boswell was somewhat of a forgotten figure.
Not exactly forgotten. That is, in the world of higher literary study, Boswell is a household name. He authored the great Life of Johnson and published it in the year 1791. That is a book which not only immortalized the great Dr. Johnson himself, who would have been immortal anyway through his own wonderful works, it also immortalized Boswell. It had the curious effect, however, of placing him in Johnson's shadow. That is, he became known for about the 150 years after his death as Johnson's biographer. Then in the 20th century came the remarkable recovery of his private papers, many of which had been stashed away at his ancestral home, Auchinleck House, a couple of miles from where we are now. Others had made their way across the Irish Sea to his descendants in Ireland, called the Talbots of Malahide. Those papers were recovered after arduous and complicated effort, eventually sold to Yale University, which edits and publishes them. In the year 1950, there appeared the first volume of Boswell's private journal, the London Journal of 1762-63, and it rather astonished its academic editors by becoming a runaway worldwide bestseller. So Boswell has been known to literary history But I would have to break that statement down into two parts. He became almost better known 2 centuries after his death than he was in his own immediate lifetime, and in some ways has been better known to literary history than he has been in the wonderful county of Ayrshire, the home of his ancestral estate, Auchinleck.
What sort of a job was that, going through those papers?
In the original period, his descendants were fascinated by what they had, but were a little nervous about it. These days, in the 21st century, we take the idea of candid confessionality for granted. When I was confined at home by a ridiculous illness a few years ago, I inflicted upon myself 2 weeks of American daytime television and was shocked witless at what people admit to on national television. Boswell began to seem to me a paragon of reticence and self-concealment and pudicity. He's none of those things, but what it does show is how far ahead of the curve he was. His descendants in Scotland and then in Ireland didn't destroy the papers, although they did rip a few pages out, but they kept them, but were a bit understandably nervous about what we now know to be their very frank personal content. Boswell, well ahead of the post-Freudian era, the era of psychology and psychoanalysis and self-introspection, Boswell had a sense of writing as a therapy, as a way of assuaging the pain that we all will, as an inevitable feature of being alive, feel from time to time. And he knew the corollary of that, which was that people reading another person's account of distress and trying to battle through it would feel curiously and almost paradoxically comforted by that reading experience.
I think he was more important looking back than Johnson.
They were important in very different ways. Johnson will remain forever in the pantheon as a pioneering lexicographer. He was known for many years as Dictionary Johnson after his great and quirky but great Dictionary of the English Language came out in 1755. He was a brilliant moral essayist. His essays as The Rambler and The Idler stand up to reading now as burly, commonsensical, practical wisdom, lay sermons in a certain sense. His wry anti-novel, Rasselas, Prince of Abyssinia, will hold its own anywhere as a coming-of-age story, a quest for experience and knowledge that goes a bit funny at the end. It may even be that the young people know more than the elderly tutor Imlac actually does. They were different kinds of people. Boswell, now known as a pioneering figure in biography, but also a pioneering figure given his 20th century literary rebirth in the kind of candid confessional writing that Johnson himself would not have undertaken, being a very different personality.
Now, Johnson is famously, or perhaps as a joke, he's derisory to the Scots, and Boswell was a proper Ayrshireman. Did the two of them get on?
They got on famously. It's a complicated story, and I'm not even sure I, at this distance of time, can actually unravel how serious and how jokey Johnson was when he occasionally cracked his clever but sarcastic wit against the Scottish nation. We all know the famous dictionary definition of the word oats, a grain which in England is fed to horses, but which in Scotland supports the people. Boswell, who occasionally gave back as good as he got, was heard to remark, "Ah, sir, but what horses and what people?" To speak seriously for the moment, there were antagonisms between Scotland and England, even with the Union of the Crowns in 1603 and the Act of Union in 1707. English people like Johnson, who were alive at the time of the second Jacobite uprising, never really knew if there might be another one at some future point. There were political and doctrinal realities. Some of the witticisms, I do think, were just that, and a few of them were made playfully at his friend Boswell's expense. I'll say this about Boswell. He himself undertook the re-education of Dr. Johnson. Their famous tour to the Highlands and Hebrides in 1773 is one in which the older man was educated by the younger. Boswell tells us in his Journal of a Tour to the Hebrides that Johnson went home in great good humour, with his prejudices much lessened, and very grateful for the hospitality he'd been shown here, proving yet again that most things like national prejudices really are no more than a function of ignorance and occasionally arrogance.
Now, while Gordon Turnbull oversees Boswell's papers, Paul Tankard from the University of Otago in New Zealand has a different approach.
My collection is a collection of things that he did write for publication, but in ephemeral forms, in newspapers and magazines. So he wrote 600 or so pieces for newspapers and magazines, and on the whole, they haven't seen the light of day since the 18th century. They get occasionally looked at by scholars who are wanting to fill in Boswell's biography, but no one's really looked at them in their own right as a body of material. And I was fascinated by the idea that there were these 600 things out there that had never been sifted through, gathered together. And so the challenge for me was to craft out of that a book that would represent Boswell as a journalist in all of his capacities. It could have been twice as long. There were other categories of material I could have included, his theatre reviews, his book reviews, and things about the law. He wrote about the law quite a bit, but instead I confined it to what I thought people would find most interesting, the life of Johnson, material about executions, actual reportage that he did, and a series of political, scurrilous political essays that he called The Rampager.
These were published anonymously, so did he keep copies of them, or did you have to go look for them following clues in his journal?
Last century, Frederick Pottle, who was in charge of the Boswell Editions office before Gordon Turnbull, he had done most of the bibliographical work on Boswell, and using Boswell's journals and also using Boswell's collections of clippings, Boswell kept everything, and as we heard before, the family kept everything as well. Using those materials that only came to light in the early 20th century, it became possible to begin to identify the things that Boswell had written for newspapers.
We think fake news is something of today, but Boswell was quite a practitioner of fake news in his day.
In a sense, in the 18th century, most of the news was fake, or at least news that was true was the exception, or we could put it another way and say that the things that were in newspapers, nobody expected them to be true. Some of them were, some of them weren't. What the newspapers recorded were things simply that were in circulation. And I don't think anybody had a real expectation that if you read it in the newspaper, it was necessarily true. It might have been, or it might not have been, and it didn't sort of matter a lot. I suppose if they were reporting the shipping news and court movements, things like that, they would have been accurate. But when it came to reporting other things like, you know, a certain literary gentleman was seen dining at the home of a certain Hibernian cleric visiting London, then people weren't identified. People who are in the know might have known what was being referred to. It might have been true, it might not have been. There were all sorts of other reasons for things being in the newspaper. And it was a completely different way of conceiving the newspaper, and it was more like the blogosphere of today. It was things that people wanted other people to think true or false.
Not much has changed.
Well, I think that, in fact, in the 20th century, when a lot of papers wanted to identify themselves as journals of record that could be relied upon to represent what had gone on a day-to-day basis, that's a bit of an anomaly, really, and that it's a sort of a 20th century invention. And in the 18th century, I think that newspaper readers would have read far more critically and cynically than we do, thinking to themselves, well, I wonder why this is in the newspaper, and I wonder who's contributed to it. And that was part of the story. Who might have put it in? Who might have contributed it? What might their interest have been? And then to assess whether it might have been true and might have been false.
And Boswell used the newspapers to his own ends.
Oh, yes, yes. If he had a cause that he was involved in, he wouldn't hesitate to publicise it through the papers. At the end of his career, when he devoted himself mostly to writing the life of Samuel Johnson, for the 9 years that he was writing it, he would feed the newspapers things about Johnson and about himself and about the life of Johnson, about other biographers of Johnson, all of which he hoped would keep up interest. And none of these things would have his own name on them, or some of them. The occasional one would when he wanted to make an official pronouncement, but most of the time they wouldn't have his name on them. They were just little things that were intended to keep people thinking, oh, Samuel Johnson is still important, is still an issue, and Mr. Boswell is still working on his biography, and that's all interesting and exciting. And if he, a couple of times he was involved in legal cases that he wanted to sway public opinion, or at least he wanted people to be interested in the case, and he would again feed things to the newspapers about what was going on in the case, and not under his own name, of course, because that would have undermined it. So it was a way of affecting the climate of opinion and keeping something current.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood. You can find out more about this year's festival online at boswellbookfestival.co.uk. And James Boswell's Life of Samuel Johnson is available from the RNIB Library as TB 5715. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you've found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line at readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
The Bookshop in Wigtown is Scotland's largest second-hand bookstore. As we'll hear, its owner, Sean Biffle, is passionate about his job. Last year, his Diary of a Bookseller became a surprise success. It's frank and funny, and it's out now as an audiobook. So here's another chance to listen to the interview I recorded with Sean at last year's Wigtown Book Festival.
Orwell's reluctance to commit to bookselling is understandable. There is a stereotype of the impatient, intolerant, antisocial proprietor, played so perfectly by Dylan Moran in Black Books, that it seems, on the whole, to be true. There are exceptions, of course, and many booksellers do not conform to this type. Sadly, I do. It was not always thus, though, and before buying the shop, I recall being quite amenable and friendly. The constant barrage of dull questions, the parlous finances of the business, the incessant arguments with staff and the unending, exhausting, haggling customers have reduced me to this. Would I change any of it? No.
So, I'm delighted to be joined by Sean Biffle, who owns The Bookshop in Wigtown, one of the many bookshops, but this one is The Bookshop, and he has just had his Diary of a Bookseller published. So, Sean, tell us what it's all about.
Essentially, it's the sort of minutiae, the day-to-day humdrum of what happens in a secondhand bookshop. And it's written every day there's an entry. And it explains the sort of mechanics of how the business works. And I think the thing that people seem to like about it is the customer interactions, because you do get have some very odd conversations with people in bookshops, which you probably don't get in other sorts of retail.
Such as?
Well, you always get hagglers every day. Today I've had one, someone who found a book for £220 and wanted it for £150. So that's pretty much a feature of the day-to-day running of the business. I don't know, but a lot of people come in looking for a book. You say you haven't got it, and then they carry on telling you why they want it, and at which point I think, why are you wasting my time? So, I mean, things like that, I suppose because every interaction's different, you know, you get the same patterns occurring, but such as the hagglers, but everyone does it differently, and some people are quite polite and friendly, and other people are quite rude and aggressive. So I suppose it's an attempt to show some of the range of the way people behave towards other people. But although I do give specific details, I like to think it's an eye-opener on the way people can behave and how rude some people are capable of being.
When I first saw the bookshop in Wigtown, I was 18 years old, back in my hometown and about to leave for university. I clearly remember walking past it with a friend and commenting that I was quite certain that it would be closed within the year. 12 years later, while visiting my parents at Christmas time, I called in to see if they had a copy of Three Fevers in stock by Leo Walmsley, and while I was talking to the owner, admitted to him that I was struggling to find a job I enjoyed. He suggested that I buy his shop, since he was keen to retire. When I told him that I didn't have any money, he replied, "You don't need money. What do you think banks are for?"
And everybody's talking about it. I have heard people reading out passages and guffawing with laughter. Clearly, it's very much caught the imagination of this book town and further afield.
I very much hope so, because selling books is not an easy business. But I'm delighted that you've heard good reports of it, because I haven't really... I'm so immersed in it that I can't see it objectively anymore. It's just a thing. I'm glad people seem to be enjoying it, and it is coming out as an audiobook as well.
Fantastic. In the near future, is it being recorded now?
It's being recorded right now. So I can't remember who the actor is who's reading it, but apparently he's quite highly regarded. And the rights, there was a little competition for the audio rights between Audible and another audiobook production company whose name I forget. And in the end, I decided not to go with Audible because they're owned by Amazon. And most of the book is... A theme running through the book is the destructive force that Amazon has exerted on an awful lot of business, but certainly bookshops have really suffered.
And you have met force with force. I have heard that you've made a few videos about the much-loathed Kindle.
Correct, yes. I've done 3 or 4 videos that at the first few seconds you would think it's an instruction tutorial on how to repair a damaged Kindle. And in the end, I've shot one with a 12-bore. I've hammered one to pieces with a huge hammer. And I've set fire to one to turn it into a Kindle fire.
Hello and welcome to another Kindle tutorial. This time, I'm going to be showing you how to convert an ordinary Kindle, in this case a broken one, into a Kindle Fire, which is Amazon's flagship Kindle. Kindle Fire is Amazon's equivalent of the Apple iPad, which I have here. And with one very simple operation, we can convert this broken ordinary Kindle, which costs about £50, into a Kindle Fire. All you need is a Kindle, some petrol, and a box of matches.
Well, you've got your diamond, and you've got your pretty clothes, and the chauffeur drives your car. You let everybody know, but don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Well, that seems to have done the trick, and I think it's a significant improvement on the original Kindle. Perhaps not quite as good as the iPad, and definitely not as good as a book.
Bearing in mind that your book is being made into an audiobook, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I do like audiobooks because part of the job running the bookshop requires me to go to travel a lot, so I'm going to people's houses to buy their granny's books after she's died, whatever. So I'm in the car quite a lot, and I mainly listen to Radio 4. But I do quite like an audiobook as well. So I particularly, although I'm not a huge fan of Tony Robinson. I think he did the Terry Pratchett books extremely well. So those are probably the favourites of what I've read so far, or I've listened to so far as audiobooks.
And will you be able to listen to The Diary of a Bookseller yourself, or will you be cringing behind the steering wheel?
I would undoubtedly be cringing. I'd probably cause a massive pile-up on the motorway or something. So I've had to reread it and rewrite it several times, so I'm pretty sick of it by now, to be honest. And I do read bits of it and think, oh my God, how could I have written that rubbish? But other people seem to like it, so as long as that trend continues, I'll be happy.
Well, as I say, it seems to be flying off the bookshelves here. I'm very much looking forward to listening to it as a talking book and any sequel that you may come up with. Presumably there is more material coming in every day.
Absolutely, and I'll be writing about meeting you in today's entry. So I've kept it going for, well, it's still going, and the year that's been published covers 2014, February 2014 to 2015. So I'm currently rewriting the second year, and I've got to send that to my agent. I said I'd do it before the festival, but I just haven't had time. So hopefully there will be at least one sequel, but I'm not banking on it.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed, and I'll see you again next year for an update. Sean, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Less than a year later, on the 1st of November 2001, a month to the day after my 31st birthday, the place became mine. Before I took over, I ought perhaps to have read a piece of George Orwell's writing published in 1936. Bookshop Memories rings as true today as it did then, and sounds a salutary warning to anyone as naive as I was that the world of selling second-hand books is not quite an idyll of sitting in an armchair by a roaring fire with your slipper-clad feet up, smoking a pipe and reading Gibbon's Decline and Fall, while a stream of charming customers engages you in intelligent conversation before parting with fistfuls of cash. In fact, the truth could scarcely be more different. Of all his observations in that essay, Orwell's comment that many of the people who came to us were of the kind who would be a nuisance anywhere but have special opportunities in a bookshop is perhaps the most apposite.
Robin Lang narrating The Diary of a Bookseller, written by my guest Sean Biffle. The Diary of a Bookseller is available commercially in print, audio, and even as an e-book. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.